Chapter 4. With the Russians in Brest-Litovsk. In the evening of the next day I arrived at Brest, a big city on the border which was occupied by the Russians. Unlike my hometown of Rajin, where everything was dark, either out of fear, or as a way of not provoking the Germans, the streets and houses of Brest were more than well lit. Gigantic portraits of Marx, Lenin, Stalin, and other heroes of that time were brightly illuminated, while people filled the streets with song and laughter. I was quite impressed. That was how I imagined freedom would be. Very soon, however, I was confronted with the seriousness of life. The city was hopelessly overcrowded with refugees. It was almost impossible to find a place to sleep. I had little money and even less experience, being on my own for the first time in my life. I had neither relatives nor friends in Brest, with the exception of one friend who lived with his aunt. I stayed with him in their overcrowded house. We slept on thin straw mattresses on the floor. Of course, I found out why the streets were so festively decorated and illuminated on my first evening in Brest. It was the eve of November 7th, the 24th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. On the morning of the big day, there was a great deal going on in the streets, marching bands, military parades, music, singing, and young people dancing. There were pictures and gigantic portraits of all the communist heroes. Of course, Stalin's portrait was the biggest of all. Stalin big, Stalin bigger, and Stalin even bigger. Some of his pictures were so large they were hung from two beams, which had to be carried by six people on each side. Even I looked festive. I had brought my best clothes with me, and now I was wearing them for this occasion. I put on a pair of handsome boots which were perfect for the ceremony, and I felt correspondingly comfortable and in good spirits. I admit that on that day I forgot about my Zionist attitude and all my troubles. The communists were right. Freedom for everyone. Why should one fight only for the Jewish and Zionist causes? We Jewish boys discussed this subject for days and nights. Our opinions were always divided, and we were never able to agree on the better and more just way. On that day, however, influenced by the euphoria and gala atmosphere, even I was willing to forget my previous views and to admit my errors. The communists were actually right. With all my strength, I fought my way into the parade in the hope of obtaining a place in the front, so that I could purposely carry one of the oversized Stalin portraits. As a sort of reconciliation, I wanted to carry the picture myself, regardless of how large it was. I soon felt the heavy beam press against my shoulder. Periodically, I glanced up at Stalin and saw him benevolently smiling down at me. I still felt thankful and indebted to him. At that time of year, it was cold and rainy. The roads were muddy and my shoes were soon soaked. Cold and dampness crept into my body, and from minute to minute I felt more miserable. Looking up again and again, I thought that Stalin must have felt the same way. He seemed to become progressively more indignant. Looking down cynically, this human god seemed to enjoy the ignorance of the people. Finally, I asked myself, why any human being should be a god and be served? I suddenly changed my attitude and let others carry him. I left angered at the demonstration and promised myself never to carry or serve any human god again. To this day, I've lived up to this promise. During my further stay in Brest-Litovsk, I met some of my best friends from school and Hashomer Tzair. We spent our time discussing old topics, new situations, and inevitably admiring the Red Army. None of us was able to find a job. As a refugee, one could only find temporary arrangements. The meaning of life was limited to enjoying freedom and admiring it, along with those who liberated us. In the meantime, our worries grew and our pockets were becoming empty, our shirts dirty and our feet wet. We were hungry and felt miserable. What to do? A few loyal communists either found important municipal jobs or left for the center of Russia. The others who stayed, they were the majority, did a lively and humorous business with Russian soldiers who were curious about any consumer goods they did not know. Every day, thousands of merchants gathered in the marketplace, the so-called Tolchok. The Russian soldiers had a lot of money and bought everything. There it was possible to sell two right or two left shoes of different sizes, or even one shoe alone. Trade of nightgowns as evening gowns and brassieres flourished in the hands of the soldiers. Watches, particularly, were in demand. Even if a Russian soldier already had two watches, one on each wrist, he still purchased more and wore them, one on top of the other. Alarm clocks were also in demand. They did not have to work as long as the alarm rang. The ticking could be simulated by the seller himself, or by friends standing by. It was the only place where literally anything could be bought and sold. Laughter was heard constantly. One laughed at the other, the sellers laughed at the buyers, and vice versa. Each one regarded the other as the stupid one. After so many years of isolation since the revolution, the Russians again saw another world, and the world saw the Russians. It was as if a curtain had been raised, and the reality of another world revealed. We Jews, who already had experienced life under the Nazis, did not dare to criticize. Rather, we were happy and thankful to be able to live in freedom. That much we appreciated. We tended to see everything as positive, and were careful not to make any negative remarks, nor to tell jokes. Even humor could be dangerous. But my friends and I saw ourselves in a hopeless situation. We therefore decided to go to Russia voluntarily. For outsiders like us, it was not easy to reach this center of paradise. We reported for registration and had to wait all night before being examined and finally accepted. We were assigned to the coal mining district of Donbass. Happy and content, we went home. A few days later, we were to present ourselves at the railway station in Brest, from where we would be sent to our destination. I told my friends of my good luck, and with a knapsack on my back, reported to the station at the scheduled time. There were hundreds who had gathered to be transported. Among them were my friends Simon Levender and Alter Engelmann. But then, like a bolt of lightning, Mrs. Weissgross appeared at my side. She had lived in our neighborhood for years, knew my family, and claimed that she had even been at my Brit Milah. She took me aside and said that she would not let me go to Russia, from where her sons and relatives had just returned. She claimed to know the truth, and therefore her conscience could not accept my going there alone. She also tried to persuade my friends not to go, but had no success with them. Perhaps she had not attended their Brit Milahs. My two friends did not change their minds, and on that evening left by convoy for Russia. While I returned to the city with Mrs. Weissgross, I never saw my friends, nor Mrs. Weissgross again. They died in Russia, as I learned from their relatives. Now I was entirely alone, without a roof over my head or any means of supporting myself. I was consumed by homesickness and a desire to be with my family, regardless of whether my homeland was occupied by the communists or the Nazis. Since I saw no future for me in Brest, I decided to go home. I travelled by train to the border, where I met other people who had the same intention and headed for the same destination. The Russians gathered us into groups. We told them we had just come from the German side. That was reason enough to be sent back. I do not know whether they believed our story, but in any case they showed understanding and patience. As soon as we reached the other side of the border, we scattered, each of us going our own way. I returned home and was welcomed like a long-lost son. I have often asked myself whether my returning home was right. I was to regret it many times later. It did not take long for the Russians to start sending all so-called Western refugees, i.e. those from the occupied part of Poland, eastward. Usually they landed in Siberia, in work camps or prisons, and were treated as deportees and convicts, according to Russian law. We exchanged letters with the ones we knew for a while. Life was difficult there, but they were neither tortured nor exterminated. In their letters one often sensed a longing for house and home. Some even envied us because we had stayed home. No wonder. Who could imagine, without having lived through it, what it meant to be a Jew in the so-called general government under the Nazi murderers? When the Russo-German war started, all connections with the so-called deportees in the East were broken. It did not take much longer until even they knew that we were only to be pitied.